Welcome to Social Justice Matters, a podcast from Social Justice Ireland. I'm Eamon Murphy, Economic and Social Analyst with SGI. Our Social Justice Matters podcast comes in a few different formats. We'll be uploading interviews on topical issues, and our 10-minute lessons are a series of short introductions to important policy areas. This episode is the sixth in our seminar series, where we publish some of the most important or relevant presentations from past SGI events. For this week's podcast, we're giving you a chance to listen on the go to Professor Charles Clark's presentation from our Global Justice Day conference just last week. Charlie is Professor of Economics at St. John's University in New York and a co-author of our Sustainable Progress Index, a publication analysing Ireland's performance on the SDGs and comparing us to the other countries of the EU 15. You can download this for free from our website, socialjustice.ie. Charlie's presentation last week looked at the concept of GDP and offers a critique as to why it is not a satisfactory measure of human well-being. His presentation incorporates a brief history of the concept, references Ireland's financial crisis, and how GDP relates to the Sustainable Development Goals. We hope you enjoy it.
25 years ago, Sean asked Catherine and I if we could come up with an index to sort of put up against gross domestic product, which is the main way economists measure things. And back then it was very hard. There weren't many examples. We came out with a study in 1996 based on the Index of Social Health, which was just started in the United States. And at the time, we were the outliers. People were still defending GDP. But today, most Nobel Prize-winning economists will say GDP is not a good measure of social well-being. In fact, the manual used to instruct countries on how to make GDP or national income accounting systems more uniform at the United Nations, which is SNA 2008, Systems of National Accounting, mentions that this is not a good measure of social well-being. GDP is designed for something specific in terms of informing governments and some decisions, but mostly to give some data analysis that help businesses make decisions. And GDP was developed to help the United States and England plan for World War II and how much military production they would be able to accomplish during the war. They had to calculate how many bombs and how many tanks could we make, and this is how the national income accounting systems were created. So they're useful information, but in terms of how a country should rearrange all their policies, this is not necessarily the best guide of whether we're doing the right things, because you could have a booming GDP and for the average person not to be able to feel it so much. Let's see. Okay. So I'm going to just give a quick overview of relationship between economic growth and progress and why having broader measures, I think, is more useful, and then look at some issues in terms of measuring, particularly in relation to, we'll do a short look at using the broader approach of the SDGs to look at something like the Great Recession and how you respond to that in Ireland, just as an example. Okay, and a good example of this sort of new way of approaching public policy is New Zealand's well-being budget. This is something that's recommended by the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development. The United Nations, different agencies have been pushing this. So this isn't some sort of left-wing idea or a hippie government. This is what leading experts are suggesting governments should do. And it's not throwing out normal budgeting, it's not counting things in a different way, or it's laying out what are the priorities based on what actually improves people's lives, how are they going to achieve it, and for a government budget, mostly that means what expenditures of money or what changes in laws we're going to enact in order to have this result, but then also laying out indicators so that we can assess, is it working? Is the policy actually having the effects? Can we monitor it to see Are we doing the right thing? Should we change strategy? That's very important to be able to not just have a feeling and not to have policy designed by ideology, but to have evidence that shows whether you're achieving the goals that you lay out. And a key part of this is laying out the values upon which we are setting our priorities. This is an important part of public engagement, that as part of the political process, this gets decided as to what will be the priorities and then how are we going to achieve them. Now, the approach that social scientists use is, in one couple cases, has been called the Anaximander principle, but it's based on the famous first line of Tolstoy's book, happy families are all alike, every unhappy family is unhappy in its own way. And that is, you set out what are the factors that make for a happy family, and then you assess the unhappiness based on how they deviate from those. This is how social scientists try to be scientific, by looking at what are the fundamental factors. In economics, we would say, what are the long-run factors, not the short-term things that vary, but what are the persistent, dominant and persistent forces that have the always affecting what you're trying to look at, and then how do you come to understand them, measure them, and use that to guide your analysis. But there's also a trend to try to minimize those factors, because it's one thing to say, well, there are 5 important factors. If we say there are 50 important factors, well, then there's probably 0 important factors. How do you assess 50 factors in your head when you're trying to think about something? So that there is a common sense reason to try to have as few as is necessary, but the trend often goes to how to reduce it to 1 or 2. And of course, if we go back to Tolstoy with his happy families, the factors that he mentions are all what makes a happy family for the male head of the household. Now, these are important as a man, at least a male member in a household, but if you ask other people in the household, they might add to that list as something that's important, what's being neglected. So that it's important to keep in mind that how these priorities are set very much reflects who has the power to set them. And so democratizing that as much as possible is an important way to allow more voices to be heard. In setting the Sustainable Development Goals, which were built on the Millennium Development Goals, which was set by a small group of experts, the UN got a lot of criticism and so had a big effort to try to get as much input from different groups in the process, and eventually became a huge lobbying effort as each group was trying to get their particular issue as one of, if not a 17 goal, at least one of the measurable indicators. I myself added some lobbying for measures in terms of modern forced labor or human trafficking. They were going to measure child labor. I said, well, let's see if we can measure this as well. So you had a lot of this going on at the UN at the time, but they also had a considerable outreach program to young people. A former student of mine ran it for the United Nations and was going to huge festivals in different countries, setting up tents to meet young people and asking them questions, engaging them. So there was an attempt to get as many voices as possible engaged in the process. Okay, so if we look at the history of this effort to measure how economies doing, it starts with the beginning of what is a national economy. So before 1600, you wouldn't have anything that you would call a national economy. You had it was called a natural economy. You had the medieval manor, or the plantation, or the farm, or the city-state, but you didn't have a large area that looked at itself as an interconnected economy until around the 1600s or so. And what economists call the mercantilist period, 1600 to 1800, And there, population was the major indicator. If you had a big population, you were a strong, prosperous country. In The Wealth of Nations, Adam Smith refers to China's prosperity, and his evidence is that they have 200 million souls. You know, so the size of your population is a big indicator of how your country is doing. And of course, if that's your indicator, then your policy is at least partially based on how do I make it grow. And of course, what we saw is horrible ways in terms of conquering the people next to you or enslaving the people who are in other continents. The 1600, 1800 is not a period where we look at, you know, nice, peaceful economic policy. It's imperialism, colonialism, slave trade, et cetera. So population is probably, if your country has a declining population, something's probably going wrong, but it's probably not the best measure to what you want to strive to try to use as your measure and then have your policy try to influence it. It's becoming common now, but it was for a long time, migration. Because if your people are leaving your country, that's an indicator things aren't going well. If people are coming there, that's a sign that, well, this is a good place to live. It's attracting people. These are what are known as push and pull factors. Migration is a big issue in the United States and in Europe the last 15 years. And one of the ways to try to reduce migration is to eliminate the pull factors, which is if I make my country less attractive, maybe less people will come, which is not really a good policy for the people who are living there. And so running your country based on that has not worked out well. But mostly since World War II, economic growth has been the major policy goal. Before you have democracies, it was the accumulation of gold and money by the king or the merchants that dominated policy. But eventually, how much your country produces, which after World War II became measured as gross domestic product, gross national product, eventually gross domestic product per capita, and then real gross domestic product as we try to look at standards of living. So we can make everyone in this room, we can double your income by just raising your income and of course then prices raised and your real standard of living hasn't changed. And so trying to adjust for purchasing power, how much people can consume is really the indicator that economists and governments often are trying to look at. And this is based largely on the view that humans maximize utility and that the major way they do that is by consuming in a market. So that is the key variable we want to measure for how a country is doing. This gets to a lot of the reasons why there are limitations to gross domestic product, because there's a lot of spending that adds to GDP but isn't necessarily increasing well-being. So if I live in a high crime area, I'm going to put a second and third lock on my house. I'm going to buy all sorts of home security systems. Am I better off? Well, I feel like I'm better off because I'm spending the money, so I'm better off in that sense, but I would be really better off if the crime rate went down and I wasn't so afraid of spending this money defensively. There's a famous article in the New York Times when this issue started to get a lot of press that one of the best things for an economy is a man going through divorce and cancer at the same time, because you're generating expenditures like mad. I mean, cancer is very expensive, and divorce means two households, two refrigerators, two of everything, not to mention all the counseling. You know, it's really good for GDP. One of the first critics of GDP, and this is while it was being created, was a friend of John Maynard Keynes, Arthur Pigou, who once said that when I marry my housekeeper, GDP goes down. Because before I was paying her to do these things, then after she's not, but have we improved the economy? And of course, there's also a lot of things that are important that aren't going to be measured. You know, the most important factor for people's level of happiness is family and friendships. Do they have personal connections. And these are things that are not going to be measured in gross domestic product. And of course, wars, natural disasters, all these things are great for generating expenditures, and they're all good. A lot of expenditures have effects on other people. Pollution, it's good for the economy, but it's bad for everyone who is affected by the pollution. And so this has been recognized increasingly by mainstream economists as limitations that have to be addressed in understanding how the economy is doing. Ireland has its own unique problems in terms of gross domestic product, and this became very pronounced and noticeable in 2015 when the growth GDP grew by 25%, which, you know, is impossible. Ireland did not produce one-fourth more of everything in 1 year. And this is also not, you know, the first year after a huge decline. If the economy went down by 20% and then up by 25%, you could say, well, we're just recapturing what was lost. But this is many years after the decline. Ireland was out of the recession. And of course, this is fairly well known now. Most of this is due to two companies locating businesses in Ireland and booking their profits, Apple being one, where somewhere in Dublin there's an office that owns the patents for the rest of the company. And any unit in the company that uses those patents on paper, I think somewhere in California, the money is transferred to that office, booked as a profit because of a low tax rate, and then dispersed to shareholders and all the other places the profits go to. Is this output in Ireland? No, it's not. And so because of Ireland's tax laws, we have an increasing use of this. So we see in table one on, I guess it's your left-hand side, Ireland, second highest in our 15-country group, and GDP per capita, 56.6% above the EU 15 average that we use. That just isn't reasonable. Whereas if we measure in terms of actual household consumption, then Ireland is just at the average. You know, it's 0.1% above the average. Well, that is something that we could say, yeah, that sounds reasonable. And so, in fact, the government calculates, but I haven't found anyone using it, but it's good that they're calculating. The CSO calculates an adjusted GDP that tries to take away all the benefits of the foreign enterprises being located in. But even then, there's probably some exaggeration because 25% in 2015 is ridiculous, but 9.4 is also probably an exaggeration of some sort. Okay, so the big trend now is coming up with some sort of quality of life measures. And the Sustainable Development Goals are an example of this. Interestingly enough, a big push in the impetus towards this area is Dwight Eisenhower, President of the United States from 1953 to 1960, who famously, when he left office, gave a speech on warning us about the military-industrial complex. In the same year, set up a commission that warns about what they call the affluence paradox. And that is, we're getting richer and richer and richer, and yet the people's lives aren't improving in the same proportion. And a lot of people, and that poverty could grow at the same time the economy is healthy and booming. Eisenhower was way ahead of his time. And so from that commission, which full report came out after he was out of office, we start to get a generation of a lot of social statistics, health statistics, going beyond just measuring output. And so we have in figure eight, a economist used the commission's recommendations in 62, based on 1975 data, came out with an analysis, which I've taken out that our 15 countries, to show a few things. One, where Ireland is in 1975 with our other comparables, but also we see that the influence of GDP slows down considerably as it increases. That means you can see at the beginning at low incomes, increasing income helps, but at some point it starts to flatten. In figure 9, using the very extensive social progress indicator, this is one of the big setups that looks at, platforms that looks at, you know, I think 74 different factors, and there we see that there's a strong significant for poor countries. They look at 156 countries. These are the orange. But once we get to above 30,000 in per capita GDP, we see it flattens out. In fact, the R-square is 0.0087, which means income is not having an effect where your country's social progress index score is not a function of its income level. And we see many examples of this, particularly the United States, one of the richest countries. We do horribly on health outcomes. You know, for most health outcomes, the United States doesn't make the top 30. Things like infant mortality or life expectancy after a cancer diagnosis and all sorts of health statistics that you figure that the country that's at the cutting edge of medical research would perform really well in. You know, and if you're affluent, America has the greatest healthcare you can get, but you have to be affluent and have that coverage. If you don't, then you're just excluded from that. And then many areas of urban areas in America have infant mortality rates that fit more in developing countries than they would in the richest country in the world. And so it's not so much how the economy is doing or how GDP is doing, it's all these other factors. And then we take a quick look, which I will take a very quick look at. If we look at the Great Recession, not just through the lens of unemployment and GDP, which is the way that most economists limit themselves, but start bringing in some of the sustainable development goals, we get, I think, a broader understanding and also one that informs policy. So in figure 10, we have, you know, a perfect summation of how an economist would look at the Celtic Tiger. GDP is going up and unemployment goes down and then flattens out around 5%. Let's call that 5% full employment. Game over. Everything's well. We can all retire. And this is all good news that the economy's doing well and unemployment's low, et cetera, but is that the whole story? Then the Great Recession hits, and again, I apologize. It was advice from economists in Wall Street that made everyone in the world suffer. The basic advice is you don't have to worry about fraud and cheating. Turns out you do. Again, I point out the obvious. Okay, and then we see GDP per capita goes down, unemployment goes up. But unemployment doesn't go up uniformly. In fact, the gender differences between unemployment rates were significant in most of the countries, partly because the boom was so construction heavily influenced that males were much more dramatically affected than in other recessions. But also the long-term unemployment rate is much more important than the short-term unemployment rate in terms of having a lasting effect. So the short-term unemployment for an economist is easy to solve. Just get someone to spend more money. You can get the government to do it through deficit. You can try to get business to try to do it, or you can, as Larry Summers told Barack Obama, you can create another bubble. How do you recover from a collapsed bubble? Create another bubble. But, you know, so getting people to spend isn't the hardest thing in the world. But if the problem is long-term unemployment, well, they're not going to be as affected. They're not going to be absorbed back as quickly. Also important was NEET is for youth not in employment, education, or training. Now, here we compare Ireland with our EU 15. So at the beginning of the recession, Ireland is equal to the average for the 15 countries. everyone goes up, it's a major recession, this is going to happen, but Ireland more than doubles. So clearly the other countries were doing things to keep youth engaged that Ireland wasn't. This is not, you know, go to the moon rocket science. This is, let's look at what they do to keep youth engaged, because you have 8-9 years of youth not engaged, that's a generational impact. I mean, these are problems that will be coming back for the rest of their lives. Their incomes will be significantly lower. Their engagement and attachment to the formal labor market will be much less. So this is something that you have to not let happen in order to avoid the problems. It's not something, well, let's let it happen, then deal with the problems after it. It's too late then. Other aspects in terms of the poverty rate, again, here we see the poverty rate by age groups, and we see, of course, the poverty rate goes up for everyone except for 55 and older. Well, again, that tells you that you have to have different policies that address different groups. There's another thing which I go into a bit in the study, and that is there are two basic ways of measuring poverty. And in the United States, we have a budget, and then that we figure a poor family, this is how much they need to survive, and we just increase that by inflation, and that's our poverty threshold. Now, if the economy is growing, that's a very bad way of measuring it. And if the economy is growing and it's 30 years, 50 years later, it's a really bad way of measuring it. However, if the economy is shrinking, that's a better measure than what Europe does, which takes as a percentage of median income. Well, if the economy is growing, that shows you where you're fitting in a growing pie. But if it's shrinking, it underestimates the count of those who are poor, because incomes fall, and so their proportion falls, but their expenditures aren't going to fall by as much. And so, you know, rents didn't go down by 20%, and food didn't go down by 20%. So if incomes went down, or the threshold went down by 20%, we're assuming everything else did. Well, this is not hard to calculate. We can look at how their budgets changed. And so having a more nuanced understanding would, I think, have a better sense of how the poor were being affected during a downturn. And then the next graph looks at Ireland's commitment to, this is Sustainable Development Goal 17, to the developing world. And of course, this collapses considerably. Ireland was building towards its commitment to 0.7%, and that fell dramatically and has yet to go up. But the last one I want to talk about is on the environment. Now, one of the major ways that the environment is being measured is the decoupling of GDP from the use of materials. It's domestic material consumption is one of the major ways that this is measured when you want to compare different countries. And so if you look at figure 19, it looks like, wow. Well, you expect during a recession, recession's good for the environment. So if people spend less, they're buying less, well, that means we're creating less pollution. That's good, at least at that level. And so there, we would expect it to fall, but if the economy grows and that continues to fall, that's the goal. I mean, that's the main way of governments are trying to address climate change, is how do we have rising standards of living using less materials, which will use up less of the environment, create less pollution. You know, so figure 19, you know, if you can end right there and you're in government, you do a victory lap. You know, this shows that Ireland is meeting their targets. But of course, they're not meeting the targets, because the GDP number we know is overestimated. So we see in figure 20, the adjusted GDP is much less. But also, the major reason why Ireland's domestic material consumption is going down is because we're now importing instead of using domestic materials. So if imports go up dramatically, well, then you're not really decoupling. You're just, well, we're creating the environmental effects, and we're just creating it in other countries, other areas. And a lot of success that countries like the United States and much of the European Union has had in showing statistically that they're doing very well in reducing its environmental footprint is because they've been able to move the footprint to China and to other areas. And of course, since those other areas are in the same planet, it's not really a sustainable approach if we not just to meet the goals, but to maintain healthy lives and safe lives on the planet.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this episode. Have a look at our website, socialjustice.ie, for further presentations from our Global Justice Day conference, or to download the Sustainable Progress Index, which was co-authored by Professor Clark, along with Dr. Catherine Kavanagh of UCC and Niamh Lenihan of CIT. Check back here again soon for more podcasts.